Okay, let me see if this thing's, it's there. All right, let's get back to David now. I was thinking about how I was going to really approach some of this, and that last session, I just wanted to, it just is one of the most exciting things in the world to me to read about Paul and about him coming to the end of his life as a fully educated son and being able to say those words. I know those words are said at a lot of funerals. I've fought a good fight. I've finished my course. I've kept the faith. But those are words that are reserved for sons. They really are for a fully educated son. And what the fight he's talking about is the fight of the sufferings of Christ and the adversary against him. And that's a part of being an educated son. And I just, it may be not the wisest way I should have maybe gone about it, but I just wanted to point a couple things out. And when you read those things, think of it in the framework. We're going to look at a psalm here in a moment that unless you see this in the framework of sonship, it's going to be a very difficult thing to really process what's being said. By the way, there's a passage in the book of Philippians that no one, and I mean this, unless you know sonship, no one can understand. And no Bible commentary that I've ever seen in print has been able to explain that verse because those guys didn't understand it in the framework of sonship. And in sonship, you don't have to translate it, retranslate it, correct it, change it, delete it, or add to it, or reword it. It makes perfect sense. When you see exactly where Paul was in his life and what he's driving at, you'll be able to tell me what it says when we get to it. It'll be that simple. But without it, you can forget it. So let's look at the man that God raised up in this interlude to be the foretaste, picture in advance of receiving the adoption of sons out here. And God, this would be the common, natural, expected place to find sons being talked about in an interlude where God was going to manifest His Jehovahness. He didn't have to do it, but give them a foretaste of His Jehovahness and grace out there in that kingdom when it gets itself established. He produces everything He needs to have produced here, including the very covenant by which it will be the mechanical means for Him to put His Jehovahness into effect. That's what the Davidic covenant covenanted for. It covenanted for all those green dots up there. The Redeemer, the Deliverer, the Avenger, the King, and the Blesser. Those are all five things that Israel needed to have done for them that they could not do for themselves. They had to have someone redeem them, not themselves. Someone deliver and avenge them that was not themselves. And they needed a king to reign over them, someone who was not of themselves, and someone who could bless them and give them the blessings on the basis of His Jehovahness and grace and not on the basis of their performance. Because on the basis of their performance, all they would ever merit are the curses, which are what they were just starting into. And so it makes sense to find it there. And so as we look at that and see the man and the men that God raised up to kind of be the picture of all of that, David is one of those. And David understood, as I've said, a whole bunch of things about being a son. He was that man after God's heart, and about the instruction of a son, the curriculum of sonship. He understood it. He's going to teach it. He not only understood it, he was apt to actually teach it to his son Solomon. And so David understood that the whole thing was designed to accomplish something, and he knew what it was designed to accomplish. Let me show you some things about that. Come back to 2 Samuel. Now, I want to go to 2 Samuel chapter 7 and talk and show you just a couple of things about that Davidic covenant when it was brought in. But I want to back up from there just a little bit. So come over, first of all, to 2 Samuel chapter 5. And again, when you're looking on our chart up here, you're able to come down and say, okay, we're in between the first and second courses. That first course of punishment comes in here. Books, Jude, Ruth, and 1 Samuel 1 through 16 contain the information that is designed to make it so that an Israelite, if he was properly educated, understood that the first course was coming. Those courses of punishment are given in Leviticus 26. Their meriting of them is given there and described. And then before God brings in the second course, he has this interlude. And this interlude of his peace and prosperity and all that he's going to accomplish by his business is contained in these books in 1 Samuel 16 to 1 Kings 12. That also includes the Chronicles. It includes the writings of the two men that are raised up here, David and Solomon. So you would have Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, and the Song of Solomon. And by the way, before we look at that, let me just do this. Remember, there is a sense and a sequence to all of this. When you look at especially Job, the book of Job, through the book of Malachi, there is, and I think some of this is going to run off down here, but when you go from Genesis to Esther, which takes you up to about where the fifth course of punishment begins, you have basically a historical account of the nation of Israel getting in that predicament. When you look at Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and you look at these books and Acts, you also have a historical account being given there. And without going into this in any big detail, when you look at Job through Malachi, it actually is going to occur in two different sections in your Bible. And the first section goes from what is called the books of poetry. Now we're going to find Proverbs in the middle of all of this. And it goes, those books actually have a sense, a sequence, and a structure to them where they go from milk to meat, so to speak. Most people have not a clue as to what the book of Job is about. They think Job is the book we should go to about suffering and about the angelic conflict. And there are some things in Job about suffering and all of that. The only problem is that's not the information for you about suffering. And Job is a great person to deal with and all this kind of thing. But actually, Job is a picture of the nation of Israel as the remnant is going to suffer out here. In fact, the very number of chapters in the book of Job correspond to the number of months they're going to be enduring that. There's 42. Anyway. And the Song of Solomon is about, you know, Solomon is not the guy, the good guy. He's not the beloved one in that book. Jesus Christ is. And that's not a book about Jesus and his love affair with the church, his bride, so to speak. We're not his bride. But what's interesting is the Song of Solomon is one of the last things Jesus Christ ever points the nation of Israel to and quotes. Very interesting. That's a very important book. And then you have all of the prophets, and they also go from milk to meat, so to speak, from Isaiah all the way down to Malachi. But what I'm after is that you appreciate the fact that when the remnant of Israel gets established, they're going to utilize that information at two particular points. The remnant's going to take information out of the book of from Job through Malachi, which contains their sonship education, and it contains a lot of things. Over here is the doctrine they're going to have written on their hearts. But over here is the curriculum. They're going to use that. That's why I said there's going to be some Israelites who are going to be in a situation where a particular psalm they're going to grab and it's going to apply to them. There's others who that psalm won't apply to. They're going to grab another one. They're going to have to utilize it. They're going to have the skill to be able to know to do it. They can use their Bible. They can unsheath this thing as a sword like it was supposed to be. And during the year of forbearance and mercy in the opening chapter of the book of Acts, you find them doing that. You find Peter doing that. You find Peter going back here and quoting things out of Joel. You find James and John, you find the remnant beginning to do that. Just beginning, but beginning nonetheless. And then they really are going to do that out here when the fifth course of punishment, or the final installment, the fifth installment of the fifth course of punishment gets underway. You have the whole tribulation period going on there. But what I'm after is that you understand and appreciate there's a structure to these books. For instance, Job is the description of the plight of the remnant of Israel in view of Satan and his plan of evil on this earth. That's what Job is doing. He functions as a type of the remnant of Israel. Job gets attacked by the adversary for no reason at all. And the remnant is going to experience that. At the end of the book of Job, Job loses everything, but at the end of it, he's far better off than when he started. That's the way the remnant's going to be. Job is a parallel account of what the remnant can expect to have happen to them as they endure the wrath of the Lord, the Lord's day of wrath on this earth. And then comes along that book of Psalms, and it's a collection of songs. It's the setting forth of the hope of Israel, and Israel's salvation from the plight of their being the object and successful captive of Satan and his plan of evil through the fulfillment of the mandates of the Davidic covenant. That's what I'm after. And we're going to be looking at one of those, and we're going to be going back. We're going back right here in the book of 2 Samuel to where that Davidic covenant got itself established. And David, the one who that Davidic covenant is established with, is going to write many of these songs that give Israel their blessed hope and the doctrine that they're going to be operating on in prophecy fashion, so that they cannot be victimized by the policy of evil, and by taking up those mandates and being able to function as sons underneath them. And so the son issue becomes really important, and there's your book of Proverbs. It comes right along after the book of Psalms and set forth wisdom that the remnant has to have to walk worthy of who they are as sons. The whole curriculum during the climactic stage of the program is given to them, and to do so in the eyes of the apostate religious system. Proverbs is for Israel to be, it provides for them to be fully educated as sons. But it doesn't end there. You also have the book of Ecclesiastes. I want to mention that before we get to Solomon. Because the book of Ecclesiastes, written by Solomon, sets before the remnant the foolishness and the sore travail of pursuing the wisdom of this world. Solomon becomes a man who goes through the sonship education and then allows himself to be victimized by the policy of evil. And you get the book of Ecclesiastes to set forth before the eyes of the remnant, especially the stupidity and the foolishness of trying to pursue what this world holds out as the competing source of wisdom. And he is the son who failed. Jesus is the perfect son. And the book of the Song of Solomon comes along and sets forth the blessed hope and glorious outlook of the remnant when they're delivered from the satanic policy of evil, and they're delivered by her beloved. Jesus Christ comes back and he avenges and delivers them. And there's what I'm after here is there's structure to all this. So when we're looking here, as we begin looking here at what I'm after here in the book of 2 Samuel, when we're looking at David here, this is where that Davidic covenant gets itself established. And so let's just take a look at a little bit of the background of this. David is going to now receive that Davidic covenant. There's just a couple of things I want to draw to your attention, but before we get there, you really need to see the Davidic covenant being given to David in the backdrop of what David expected to happen. And David had been educated, he'd been adopted and educated by Jesse, and David knew where he was on this timeline. David knew that Israel had merited the first course of punishment coming in. He knew that they were in a position where the second course could begin, but for some reason he knew God had delayed that, and that God was doing something really unpredicted. He was doing something that was a part of his Jehovahness to them, and it was extolling and putting on display something about that. David understood that was happening. And so there's a natural reason why David would expect God to say something and do something about implementing his Jehovahness and grace. He didn't expect God to bring the kingdom in right then. And not only that, David didn't operate on the new covenant. The new covenant hasn't been given yet. That's given on down here in the second installment by the prophet Jeremiah. So that's not been given yet. But David does have information sitting in the book of Deuteronomy to know God's going to do something with our heart. He's going to do something with our inner man. That's where all of this is going to take place. The crux to this is my heart to his heart and his heart in my heart. And that's why David is raised up as that man after God's own heart. So let's just look at that and see a little bit of the backdrop of this. Come over to chapter 5 here in 2 Samuel. Now let's pick it up at verse 1. It says, "Then came all the tribes of Israel to David unto Hebron, and spake, saying, Behold, we are bone of thy bone, we are thy bone, pardon me, and thy flesh. Also in time past," notice that even in Israel's program they have a time past. You know what's interesting? Just whet your appetite. When this dispensation ends, you get the letters of, say, Peter out here. Peter's going to talk about time past, and he adjusts this entire timeline chart. And he looks at this but now dispensation of grace and he calls it time past. Anyway, just something for you to do when you're sitting around not doing anything. Go over and check that out. He says also, it says, verse 2, in time past when Saul was king over us, thou wast he that leddest out and broughtest in Israel. And the Lord said to thee, thou shalt feed my people Israel, and thou shalt be a captain over Israel. So all the elders of Israel came to the king of to Hebron, and King David made a league with them in Hebron before the Lord. And they anointed David king over Israel. Well, now, David was anointed in 1 Samuel. Remember when Samuel came out there and got him out of Jesse's sons, all the other boys, nice big strapping boys, all looked like king. King, you know, I'd be afraid if he walked in the room. Then comes David, the little ruddy lad, you know, with the red complexion and beautiful to look at, beautiful David. I don't think I'd want somebody to describe me that way. Handsome, yes. Beautiful, I don't know. Like I said, I just couldn't describe Bob Howard as being beautiful. You're such a beautiful man. He'd have probably done me one of those karate chop things that he knows and hit a point on my neck that would have paralyzed me for 6 weeks or something. Did you get the feeling that he could have killed any of us if he wanted to? I did. I mean, I got the feeling if this guy wanted to, he could kill me like that, you know, that lying just under the surface. I was so glad he was enjoying himself here. But anyway, what I'm after is David got anointed before this. But now he gets anointed again. They anointed David king over Israel. Where were they before? But what I'm after is this. There's a reason for this because, and it has to do with the way a son, once he's even gone through the sonship education, gets dealt with by the father at a particular point to get installed into a position that he's now going to begin functioning. And notice verse 4. Remember when I told you how old was Jesus when he began his earthly ministry? Look at verse 4. David was 30 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 40 years. In Hebron, he reigned over Judah 7 years and 6 months. In Jerusalem, he reigned 33 years over all Israel and Judah. All I'm after is there's some magnificent parallels between Jesus and David. And it has to do with their sonship status. Jesus began, my understanding, in Israel and as an Israelite in Judaism, they not only had to go through school, but there was this marvelous thing that existed. It wasn't called it that at that point. Call it this today. It's now going out of phase. It's out of style. It's looked at as old and passé. But I think it's one of the best thing that you could ever have in any business organization, and that's called apprenticeship. And I think that I think a new guy should pay his dues. This idea that people get right out of college and think that they somehow have earned the right to have a six-figure salary right out of college and never know what it's like to pay their dues through the chain of command is ridiculous. But that's the entitlement attitude that we have in this country. And I thank God, I had to go through an apprenticeship when I was in printing, and I knew what it was like to just scrape old ink off of ink rollers. Real fun job. And you start at the ground and you work your way up. And by the time in Israel's program, when a man was 30 years of age, he was now ready to enter into business and be installed into that business. And David is 30 years old. I don't think it's any coincidence that the ages match. And that's all, you know, that's just one of the things I wanted to show you there. Come down to chapter 6. And we don't have time. I'm not going to go through all of this. But one of the things you need to understand, I hope and appreciate a little bit, is and I just want you to look at chapter 6, kind of let your eyes scan it. You remember that one of the things that's happening now is David's anointed as king. He's beginning to reign as 30 years of age. The Ark of the Covenant is now going to be brought into Jerusalem, the city of David. It's going to be it's going to go through the process here of remember it was stolen at one time by the Philistines. They had it. And talk about getting your hands on something you wish you never had. That was the way it was with the Ark. They wish they'd have never got a hold of that thing. It wasn't so much that Israel went and got it back, they gave it back. This thing was such a curse to them, they said, get this thing out of here, we don't want it anymore. And so they've got it, they're trying to move it. You have the account there in chapter 6 of one of David's friends, Uzzah, and he puts his hands on it, he dies, that kind of thing. But what I'm after is really what happens after that, from verse 12 on, when David is bringing the ark up, and I was going to do this, but I've changed my mind because of time. If you had read the sixth chapter, to familiarize yourself of what's going on there and the backdrop of what is happening, you would see how perfectly natural it is. Here I've got my man, God could say, here I've got the man after mine own heart. I've got him educated. I've got him now in a position of being installed as king, and he's now got a heart for my business. He's bringing the ark in. God, in fact, the way it was done, as verse 12 and following gives the account, God blesses that action. And then all of that is backdrop to God then doing something here in chapter 7. And again, everything you get there in chapter 6, David wants to bring the ark to Jerusalem, and he's after something very particular. He wants to build God a house. Why do you build a house? To live there. But not just to live there, to live permanently. That's what God, that's David's heart. Was God, you're going to have to be our God, and I know all the way back here at the beginning what your original intent for this earth was going to be. You want to live here, and I want to make that happen. And so David had that kind of heart, and he wants God's permanent residence to be there in Jerusalem, this new capital of the nation of Israel. It was also called the city of David. I know Bethlehem is called that as well, but Jerusalem is called that too. And so I just try to give you a bit of the backdrop to this, because David wants to bring up the ark into Jerusalem and build God a permanent house. And he was a man after that heart of God, and he had an understanding of what God was doing in the interlude, as I said. And he had at least, David had at least, in fact, I've got that chart. Where is that? David at least had an understanding of the first five of the Jehovah compound names. Jehovah Jireh was given back there in the book of Genesis to Abraham. God will provide himself as the sacrifice. Jehovah Rophekah there in the book of Exodus 15, the Lord that healeth thee. Israel was going to put themselves in a position of getting a wound that they could not heal. God was going to have to heal that. God, especially David, understood the third one and operated on it a lot as king. He understood Jehovah Nissi, God our conquering hero. The Nissi concept is God our banner. It's a banner of victory in battle, and God being the picture of the conquering hero of Israel, which was given through Moses back there in Exodus 17 when he was trying to educate them into his Jehovahness and grace in their staying after class issue. And then the fourth one there, Jehovah Shalom, there in the book of Judges was given, God our peace. And then David himself is going to be the one who is going to pen the 23rd Psalm, Jehovah Ra'ah, the Lord my shepherd. And he, that's what Israel needed. And these are things that the Jehovahness of God, that God calls for, to be for Israel, that they can't be for themselves. So David, at least, that's why he's saying at least a limited capacity, but at a good capacity, had an understanding of God's Jehovahness. And wasn't, you know, he knew what was going on. And all I'm after here is not to belabor the issue of David being a man after God's own heart and that issue of the sonship issue or harp on it, which I probably do, but I really want you to have it settled in your mind that when we say the statement, a man after mine own heart is a sonship statement, you really do see that's not stretching it. That's not resting the scriptures or going out of bounds just to force a point. It's a huge point. It's something God, your Father, is looking at you for. He's looking to see that is there. That you can't be put off. You'd be upset if Mark called up and said, "Oh, I got something better to do. We're not having Bible class today." That would upset your life, not to have the words of God. And not to put myself up, but it's not resting this. It's really there. It's really this is the attitude a father looks for, that signals to him, that signals to the father that his son's mind and his son's conscience and his son's attitude is set. He's now ready for sonship education to begin. And here in 2 Samuel 7, where the Davidic covenant is given, is a perfect example of that. David's heart is set now. And especially in light of what preceded it there in chapter 6 and the in the opening verses of chapter 7, David's conquests get described, his military victories, the kingdom gets unified, peace and prosperity now is beginning to persist, the ark is getting brought up to Jerusalem, everything's rolling along, and David wants to build God this house, the temple. All that's done in the midst of that first course of punishment, having come upon them, and they're meriting the second, but God pausing those punishments to bring this interlude of peace and prosperity and military victory, unified kingdom, the ark being brought back and so forth. And David knows all that's happening. And he knows it's happening not because they were any big deal. David's got the right attitude about this. He knows this is happening because of God's Jehovahness and grace. David knows Leviticus 26, and he knows that Leviticus 26 didn't say one thing about an interlude of blessing being between the first and second course of punishment. And David knows it, and he knows and now he wants to build God a house. But you need to know why. You've got to have that settled in your mind. Why does David want to do that? Why does he want to build God a house? He's just seen a demonstration of God's Jehovahness. For example, he's seen that in the military victories that he's had. He's seen the Jehovah Nissi concept, the Lord our conquering hero, and now he realizes they need to have, that's not all of it. David knew that. They need to have the entirety of God's Jehovahness implemented for them. In other words, David understood if ever there was a time, now's the time. Now is the time, almost in anticipate. By the way, that's a sonship trait. A son who really is educated will anticipate what his father wants. He knows his father's routine. He knows, all right, my father's going to be here at a particular time. He's going to expect a paper. I'm going to get it and put it there for him. He anticipates what his father's going to say and do. And that's a good son who does that. That helps relieve a lot of grief from the father. And David, almost in anticipation of that, of what God was about to do, that now is the time for God to implement his Jehovahness. David wanted God to begin living with them on this earth in Israel and doing just that. While David might not have known why God was being long-suffering totally and gracious to them, he saw it was the right time to take advantage of that issue and call for God's house to be built, so that he would make it a permanent arrangement. And so God would do for them what they couldn't do for themselves. And David perceived that, and I think he perceived that correctly, because he was a man after God. He knew what God's heart was in this matter. And while the interlude wasn't written about exactly, and it might not have been something he would have expected to have happen, David certainly understood why it was happening. And being the man after God's own heart, God indeed does just exactly that in the giving of the Davidic covenant of what David anticipated to have happen, the mechanical means of implementing his Jehovahness and grace. And this confirms to me, and I hope it does to you, that it wasn't just David that he loved the Lord so much, he said, "I want you to live here." David could have built the Lord a house in any old city. He could have built it in his hometown of Bethlehem. Why not build it there? But he conquered this city that was going to be called the City of David and later and would be called Jerusalem. And there was something about that city that connected with something David knew God was in the business of doing way back here. And it wasn't just David loved the Lord and wanted him to be around all the time, but that he understood some things about God's business and he wanted to labor with the Lord in that business. He understood what God had given to Israel, and he had been taught by his father who God was as far as his Jehovahness was concerned. He called upon that Jehovahness. He saw Israel's need for God to permanently operate with operate with Israel on the basis of his Jehovahness and grace, and he tries to build a house for that to happen, for God to come down and dwell with them and be their king. And he wanted their whatever blessings they had here, they wanted him to be their blesser. And however good of a king David was, he knew he would not be the king that God would be over them. And so therefore, to be all those things and deliver them and revenge and be especially their redeemer. Although he didn't understand it quite that way, he did understand it from those Jehovah compound names. And all of that is a backdrop for the Davidic covenant being brought in. Sonship is actually the backdrop for the Davidic covenant being put into effect. Pick it up at verse 1. It says, "And it came to pass when the king sat in the house, that the Lord had given him rest round about from all of his enemies, that the king said unto Nathan the prophet, See now, I dwell in an house of cedar, but the ark of God dwelleth within curtains. And Nathan said unto the king, Go do all that is in thine heart, for the Lord is with thee. It came to pass that night that the word of the Lord came unto Nathan, saying, Go tell my servant David, Thus saith the Lord, Shalt thou build me an house for me to dwell in? Whereas I have not dwelt in any house since the time that I brought up the children of Israel out of Egypt. Even to this day I have walked in a tent and in a tabernacle. In all the places where I have walked with all the children of Israel, spake I a word with any of the tribes of Israel, whom I commanded to feed my people Israel, saying, Why build ye not me a house of cedar? Now therefore so shall thou say unto David, Thus saith the Lord of hosts, I took thee from the sheepcote." David, remember, was the shepherd, out with the sheep. "From following the sheep, to be ruler over my people, over Israel. And I was with thee whithersoever thou wentest, and have cut off all thy..." What is he doing here? He's confirming to David, you're right. What you have seen happen has happened because of my Jehovahness. Notice the eyes. I took thee from the sheepcote, from following the sheep, to be ruler over the house of Israel. Every time he says that, that's confirming to David, God's Jehovahness has been put into effect in this interlude. "Was with thee whithersoever thou wentest, and have cut off all thine enemies." Those victories you had, that really was. You were right. That was Jehovahnessy. I'll be your conquering hero in battle. "Out of thy sight, and have made thee a great name." God did that. "Like unto the name of great men that are in the earth. Moreover, I will appoint a place for my people Israel." God's going to do that. "And will plant them, that they may dwell in a place of their own, and move no more. Neither shall the children of wickedness afflict them any more as before time. And since the time that I commanded the judges over my people..." That's another gracious thing he did. Even during the first course of punishment, he brought in judges. He didn't have to do that. We saw that. And they provided those two preliminary aspects. They avenged. "To be over my people Israel, and have caused thee to rest from all thine enemies. Also the Lord telleth thee that he will make thee an house." You see what he's doing? He's saying, you got a great idea, David, but I'm going to take it a step further. It's great that you want to build me a house of cedar, but the house I'm interested in me living in that house isn't going to resolve anything. God coming down and taking up residence in a house made by hands, the temple, isn't going to get my business totally done. I've got to get to this earth, and I've got to become one of you. So I'm after a different house. I'm after a house that has a head and eyes and nose and mouth and arms and legs I'm going to make thee an house. That is the striking feature right now that hits David. And David realizes God is now going to implement His Jehovahness and grace through me, not through the temple. The temple's got a purpose, and I'm not trying to minimize it. But the temple's got a purpose in connection with them being under the law in the first place. But David, the man David, the son of his father, has something that the father needs to have to be able to implement all of the mandates that he's going to set forth in the Davidic covenant to get them out of the position and predicament they're in, and to get you and I out of the predicament we were in. And that is, he's going to have to enflesh himself. That's one of the reasons, that's one of the doctrines those Pharisees had so screwed up, that David could call his son his Lord. If he's his Lord, how is he then his son? Right here. Here's where they went off base. I will make thee an house. Verse 12, and when thy days be fulfilled, and thou shalt sleep with thy fathers, I will set up thy seed after thee, which shall proceed out of thy bowels, and I will establish his kingdom. And there's another his, there's another he, there's another son, David, that's going to take the throne. And I'm going to do something with his kingdom, and it's going to start with you. And it's going to be your line, and it's going to be your kingdom. And that kingdom is going to go on forever. Now watch what he says here. And by the way, now what are we talking about? What's he doing with David? He's taking David into the back room, and he's opening up the safe, and he's pulling out the blueprints of his business, and he's starting to unroll them to him. He says, here's how I'm going to get my business done. David couldn't even hear this if he wasn't an educated son and a man after God's own heart. God didn't do this with any of the other big brothers of David. He did this with that one boy who had that heart that was like father, like son. And he says, he's going to tell him what he's going to do. He shall build, he says, and I will establish his kingdom, verse 13, and he shall build a house for my name. And I will establish his throne and his kingdom forever. I will be his father. This is not just going to be a king relationship. It's going to be a father-son. In other words, David now knows God is going to come into this world and enflesh himself into my line. And when he does, he's going to establish a king on my father's kingdom, on my father's throne in his kingdom. But he's not just going to be any old. He's going to be a son. He's going to be his father's son, not just any old king. I will be to him a father. This is the sonship, father-son relationship that God the Father, we talked about, that he had with his son, Jesus Christ. And he shall be my son. Notice the stress of that, being the very first thing in verse 14. I will be his father, and he shall be my son. If he commit iniquity, I will chasten him. We know the Lord didn't do that, but we know that this is something that does apply to the earthly kings that are going to sit on the throne of David, that come through David's line, especially David and his son Solomon. I will chasten him with the rod of men and with the stripes of the children of men. But my mercy shall not depart away from him as I took it from Saul, whom I put away before thee. And thine house and thine kingdom. Notice he's not talking about David's physical. He's not talking about the temple. Your house. I will make of thee an house. The house that comes out of your line. And thy kingdom shall be established forever before thee. Thy throne shall be established forever. Notice how many times he says forever, 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 forever. According to all these words and according to all this vision, so did Nathan speak unto David. Now, I just want to again touch on this because of how critically important it is to sonship education. And we're out of time, but I didn't get to the psalm I wanted to get to. That was the last thing I wanted to deal with David about. But I'll tell you what it is and give you some homework on it. But the reason I come back there is to set us up for what David is going to do. David understands God has a business to do on this earth. And he now gets a clear understanding of how that's going to get done. Now, he doesn't get the five mandates of it yet, and he doesn't see it that clearly yet, but he does see very clearly God is going to build him a house. He's going to have to come into him and enflesh himself into his line, and there is a coming king through his line. That kingdom, the very throne that David sits on, the kingdom David rules over, is going to go on forever. It's not going to go on in the same fashion that David had it, that it was in David's day. It's going to be far better. It's going to be a perfect kingdom under the rulership of a perfect king. But helps us understand and answer the question, I think, as to why David wanted to build God a house. He wanted God to implement his Jehovah-ness and grace. And the only adjustment David needed to make was that that's not going to get done through a building that you make or your son makes with hands. I'm going to let Solomon do that. And I've got a purpose for that. And the fire came down and God ignited the fire in the temple. And all of that became validated by God, and it was all for a very important purpose. But you've got to remember, that's not the way God implemented his Jehovah-ness and grace. It wasn't going to get done with a building made with the hands of men, even if God did sanction it. It's going to get done with the building God made that man couldn't make. Man couldn't make a man. God could, and God did. And the man he chooses and selects to enflesh himself in the line of, and this is what I think is so beautiful about this, it's not a man from the tribe of Levi. It's not one of the Bible teacher guys. It's a man in the tribe of Judah. Jesus was in that same tribe. And he's going to enflesh himself into the man who he holds up as the prime example until his own son gets here of what a son is all about. So I hope that as we covered this, these things that we've touched on will let you look at this and have it really firmly settled that this is the right place to go. And then as we look at David passing this on to Solomon and having Solomon write it down, that when we look at Proverbs 1 there again, and we start going through those, the reason I have you go through the first 9 chapters, by the way, in case you don't realize this, if you read the very first verse of Proverbs chapter 10, verse 1, you'll realize there, Solomon says that he identifies in verse 1 of chapter 10, these are Proverbs of Solomon. The first part of that wasn't. That was David teaching Solomon. And then Solomon begins writing his Proverbs in chapter 10. But those first 9 chapters that form Solomon's sonship education are given by David to him as a father teaching a son. And that there's a natural reason to find that. The only other thing I wanted to do was, I just thought this was so amazing to see some things. Between now and Tuesday night, take a look at the 17th Psalm. And we're not going to go over it now, but just flip over to it. Take a look at the 17th Psalm. And I've chosen this for several reasons, but one of which is it's so replete with sonship terminology and will form a nice, tidy finish to looking at David as far as we're going to look at him. By the way, there's a ton of things I've missed. If you come up and point out something in the Bible that you've seen, come and point it out to me. I'll rejoice with you to see it. Because I'll be the first one to admit, I've barely done anything. I've just tried to give you enough information where you can take your Bible and with some intelligence start looking at some things as you read through it and realize, firm up the aspect of that interlude and firm up in your thinking what God was doing with David and with Solomon. I don't have time to go through all of that right now. I'm just trying to give to whet your appetite to it. But the 17th Psalm here, and for some reason, I'm looking at the 17th chapter of Isaiah. I'm just a little bit off. The 17th Psalm, think about this when you think, and I'm going to give you a little homework here. The 17th Psalm is in which book of the Psalms? Right. Book 1. What's the first book of the Psalms about? What is it generally extolling? The Redeemer and His redemption. They're following these five mandates, right? All right. I'm going to see if you can figure this out. At the end of this psalm, the last two verses of it are totally destroyed by every other Bible translation because they're untenable to a scholar. Read through this psalm before Tuesday. Get out of it what you can, and you'll be able to get a lot of the sonship issues. But come down to the last two verses. It says, well, pick it up at verse 13. It says, "Arise, O Lord, disappoint him. Cast him down. Deliver my soul from the wicked, which is thy sword." See that phrase there in verse 14 or 13? The wicked, which is thy sword. Do you know that the scholars read that and went apoplectic? They couldn't believe that that's right. That's got to be wrong. The wicked is the Lord's sword? Oh, I don't think so. And so they retranslated this. And they would make it read something to the effect of the deliver my soul from the wicked by thy sword. Now that's what God really meant to say. He really meant to say by thy sword. And so you have the ASV and the NIV and all the other perverted versions coming along by thy sword. And they can't stand the next phrase either, from men which are thy hand, thy hand. O Lord, from the men of the... They can't stand that either. So they say, by thy hand. So they say, deliver my soul from the wicked by thy sword, from men which are by thy hand. They screw the whole thing up. Why would God say here, to deliver my soul from the wicked, which is thy sword? You'll find it out when you think about this is a psalm dealing with the first mandate of the Davidic covenant and thinking about when this was written, where they are on their timeline in light of something that's been said about where they are in their timeline. We'll talk about that, but why does he talk about the wicked being his sword? And that the men, those wicked men, are thy hand. The men of the world are thy hand. There's a particular place that's talked about that's sitting back here that they should already know. David knew it. David knew exactly what it was. He knew what Israel was involved with and what those courses of punishment were calling for. I'll cut this way down for you. You'll find it where those courses of punishment are described. You'll find that issue being described in those courses of punishment. So you'll find your answer in Leviticus 26. But when we come back on Tuesday night, I just want to go through this psalm and show you some sonship issues in it. And it again firms up the issue of the Davidic covenant coming on, the mandates of that going into effect, God putting His Jehovahness into effect, David understanding that, and the major issue of I'll be a father, he will be my son, and sonship being the crowning achievement of this particular period. So hopefully this will lay the last pieces of the track for us so that we can finally then go to Proverbs and not lose somebody by thinking, well, I'm just trying to push the issue or force it. It's really important to me that none of that is in your thinking, that you're not sitting there thinking I'm forcing us to go to Proverbs, that I'm forcing the issue of the curriculum being set forth there. And I may make some mistakes here and there, but I don't want to make that one. I want you to be able to see it and have it settled in your mind. That's the only place we would be able to find this, and logically so. So, well, we'll pick this up then next time. We'll just briefly look at this. And then I want to look at Solomon. Couple things that are said about him, and that's it. And then we'll start in Proverbs and start looking at the curriculum. And in Proverbs, all we're going to see in Proverbs really is the table of contents. And then we'll see the format. Then we'll go back to Romans and we'll learn it. So we've got a lot on our schedule. With our